So my name is Bill Hall. I'm a radiation oncologist at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I'm very excited to be presenting on MR-guided radiation therapy. These are my disclosures. We do receive departmental research and travel support from Elekta AB, Stockholm, Sweden. And I do have research support from the NIH as well as the CTSI of Southeast Wisconsin. So this is the outline of the presentation that I'll be giving radiation therapy. So let's start out with a review of the role of MRI in radiation therapy treatment planning. So MRI is a very well-established role in the treatment planning of many different malignancies. This can include head and neck cancers, primary and secondary brain cancers, bone metastases, primary and secondary liver cancers, prostate cancers, gynecologic malignancies, just a lot of cancers that have very well-established MRI treatment planning roles. So if you treat any of these malignancies, you're not routinely using or considering the registration of MRIs, please think about that because it can be quite helpful for a number of these tumors. And I've included some references if you're curious as to how MRIs may be optimally used. There's an important distinction that I want to make, which is the difference between just MR registration as well as MR-guided radiation therapy. So MR registration is really the acquisition of an MRI in a treatment planning position to help guide radiation therapy. So this is really the process of getting an MR sim or even bringing in a diagnostic MRI and just registering it with your CT simulation. MR-guided radiation therapy really represents a combination of MRI with a linear accelerator that offers real-time intra-treatment MRI image acquisition. We'll go over exactly that means. So the next thing I want to do is discuss some critical MRI knowledge for radiation oncologists. So as I get into this, I think the most helpful thing that I could pass along to any radiation oncologist interested in using MRI is that you should really become close colleagues with a diagnostic radiologist that specializes in the interpretation and the use of MRI. This is absolutely essential. We have a diagnostic radiologist that's jointly appointed in our department, and I probably interact with him on cases 3 to 4 times a week. But there's some basic information that I think all radiation oncologists that are using MRI should know that I thought I would outline for everyone. So there a simple way that you can think about sequences available on modern MRIs is to divide them into proton densities. This is very basic, very straightforward. Most radiation oncologists are probably familiar with this already. There are T1 weighted images, which can either be enhanced with contrast and or fat suppressed. There are T2 weighted images that can be fluid suppressed, for example, like a flare image, and or fat suppressed. There are diffusion weighted images and then flow sensitive images, things like MR angiography or MR venography. And then there are some miscellaneous categories, things like MR spectroscopy, MR perfusion, functional MRI, those sorts of things. It's important to know there are some general descriptive terms that are very helpful to use appropriately when describing an MRI or asking questions about an MRI. MR images should be described using the words intensity. So, for example, a high signal intensity is something that's white, a low signal intensity is black. There is also relative terms like hyper intensity, which means that something is brighter than a comparison structure, or hypo intensity, darker than a comparator structure. So, if you're used to using the word density, try to get that out of your vocabulary with MRI. It's really not an appropriate term to be describing an MR image, and should not really be used to reference an MR image in general. So these are some very basic information about MR image descriptions. This is things that most radiation oncologists are probably aware of, but just wanted to review to set some baseline levels here. So T1 weighted sequences are part of almost all MR protocols, and they're really the most anatomic of all the images that are acquired. And they closely approximate the appearance of tissues. On T1 weighted images, fluid is usually a low signal intensity, so it shows up as black. And fat is typically a high signal intensity or white. And muscle is often an intermediate signal intensity or gray. These are often contrast enhanced, and it's most commonly used gadolinium-based with regard to the actual type of contrast enhancement. And these have the effect of causing some sometimes T1 signals to be increased. Typically, the contrast is injected intravenously, and you can see, for example, an enhancing tumor here. And contrast can be quite helpful for radiation oncologists to delineate treatment volumes. And oftentimes, those post-contrast T1 sequences can also be fat suppressed and make that a little bit easier to appreciate. So a fat-suppressed image, it can also be referred to as an attenuation or saturation, is kind of a tweak that's performed on mainly T1-weighted sequences. And this suppresses the bright signal that can be seen from fat. It's performed most commonly in two scenarios. First is that probably the most common one is after the administration of gadolinium contrast. And second is if you would think something is potentially fatty and you really want to prove that, showing that it becomes dark on a fat suppressed image can be quite useful. So if you're discussing something with your diagnostic radiologist and you're wondering about fat versus tumor, it may be in some cases, not always, may be helpful to ask to use or register some fat suppression images that could potentially help some treatment volumes. T2 weighted images are again part of most almost all MR protocols. Without modification, the dominant signal intensities of different tissues are as follows. Fluid here is usually a high signal intensity, so it commonly shows up as white. Muscle is an intermediate signal intensity. Fat is often a high signal intensity as well. In the brain, gray matter is often an intermediate signal intensity, and white matter is often hypointense compared to gray matter. So, what about diffusion-weighted imaging? So, I think all radiation oncologists should try to make themselves familiar with diffusion-weighted imaging because it can be really helpful to delineating the most malignant regions of an area that you need to be focusing on. And can potentially be helpful for adaptive or boost strategies with radiation. We'll get into that in a little bit. Typically, diffusion-weighted images are referring to a combination of an actual diffusion value and a T2 signal. So it's a relatively low-resolution image with some of the following appearances. So gray matter in the brain, for example, is usually an intermediate signal intensity. It's kind of grayish. White matter is usually a slight hypointense compared to the gray matter. CSF usually has a low signal intensity, and other soft tissues often have intermediate signal intensity. So, from a diffusion-weighted image, we can get something called an apparent diffusion coefficient, or an ADC value. You probably have heard about this before. The ADC value really represents the actual diffusion values of the tissue without those T2 imaging effects or fluid signals. So these are very useful objective measures of diffusion and the movement of these water particles. However, they're very low resolution, rather grayscale images that are often inverted DWI images. So if you look at an ADC, image, these are very blurry, grainy, hard to see, but oftentimes the radiation oncologists, or excuse me, the diagnostic radiologists will look at an area and describe it as a decreased signal on ADC, which is frequently describing a tumor. And they're often describing that tumor as restricting diffusion. What that means is they often look darker on the ADC image. So if you're trying to understand where a tumor or malignant region might be, the ADC might be helpful to review with your diagnostic radiologist to really understand where those restricted areas of diffusion are occurring. Again, pretty much all of this should take place with a diagnostic radiologist that specializes in the interpretation of MR-based images. They can be really, really helpful for you to understand these. But the bigger picture here is that you can go to almost any solid tumor in the body, and you can find, in many, many cases, series that describe close correlations with changes in tumor ADC values and various clinical endpoints. So this is one, for example, in pancreatic cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy. This is one for rectal cancer patients. There's similar reports for patients with gliomas. There's lots in cervical cancer. There are several in prostate cancer, but these are really interesting publications that could be quite relevant in the era of MR-guided radiation therapy. And I'll get into that a little bit more as we go further through the presentation. So this is an example of a lot of different values that could potentially be used as imaging biomarkers of treatment response, of which ADC represents a very promising potential imaging biomarker of treatment response that radiation oncologists maybe want to could potentially want to pay close attention to in the future. And this just again reinforces the differences here between MR simulation, which is something that can be used in and at the time of CT simulation and registered to CTs for treatment planning, and MR-guided radiation therapy, which really represents the integration of an MR imaging device with a linear accelerator. And we'll get into that more throughout the course of this presentation. So if you're interested in starting to use MRI more, or you potentially have an interest in MR-guided radiation therapy, this is a very useful publication to understand some of the basics for radiation oncologists. This is Ulke van der Heide from the NKI in the Netherlands, a close collaborator of mine, and he wrote a really nice article in Clinical and Translational Radiation Oncology that I think might be a nice read for radiation oncologists interested in and using MRI more frequently in their practice. So there's a couple take-home points for this. Specifically for target delineation, you often need a series of separate image sets that are used with distinct image contrast, kind of like we went over initially in the introductory slides here. MR images can suffer from image distortions. This is very, very important for radiation oncologists to understand. If you're using MRI images to really guide treatment volumes, you have to recognize that they can be distorted. Even things like metal or loss of signal can result in significant distortions in your MRI. So you have to be cognizant of that, be looking for that, and be working closely with an MR physicist, especially if you're using these for the purposes of MR-guided radiation therapy. The strong magnetic field of an MRI scanner and the use of radiation can cause some safety issues if they're not appropriately addressed. We'll get into that in the presentation as well. And the most important thing I could emphasize to all the radiation oncologists is that safety screening is absolutely critical. You really need to be safety screening every patient, and also therapists and operators of the machine, as well as radiation oncologists and nurses. This is a very new thing for many radiation oncology departments. You're used to working with CT, where you can just walk into a room. You don't have to take off your stethoscope or pens or a cell phone out of your pocket. This is an absolute necessity for the use of MRI. You must be screened carefully. You have to make sure all of your metal is removed from your pockets. And this is something that will require a significant amount of education for any departments interested in working on MR-guided radiation therapy. So, what are some cases that might be good candidates for consideration of MR-guided radiation therapy? Well, there are three general tumors that we've been using MR-guided radiation therapy for quite frequently. And those are tumors that require ablative or high doses of radiation that are in close proximity to moving radiosensitive structures. So ones that immediately come to mind are if you have a tumor that needs an ablative dose of radiation that's very close to the bowel, that's going to be moving and changing quite a bit during treatment. You want to be watching that structure ideally while the beam is on, making sure that that structure is not moving into a high dose ablative region, and ideally accounting for it for its particular position on a daily basis. That's really an ideal situation for MR-guided radiation therapy. Tumors that are not well visualized on a non-contrast CT that would be used for image guidance, or tumors that are in an area that require fiducial placement, but that's very difficult to access. So there are certain liver tumors that potentially would be good options for this, or tumors that would require fiducial placement that are in or located in close proximity to really critical vascular structures. And then additionally, tumors that are changing very rapidly in size or position during the course of treatment that you're very confident will require multiple adaptive plans might be another category of patient that could be considered. So if you are going to consider MR-guided radiation therapy, let's take a look at some of the technologies that could be used for that. For anyone interested, this is a review article that we recently published in the European Journal of Cancer that goes over some of the different MR-guided radiation therapy technologies that could be potentially used. And so this is a table from that publication that I just offer as a reference, kind of going over two of the commercially available units, which include a ViewRay unit as well as an Elekta unit. And ViewRay has been through a couple iterations of their unit. Initially, it was a Cobalt 60 unit, and now they've converted into a linear accelerator. And then Elekta had about a year ago their 1.5 Tesla MR-Linac approved by the FDA, which is now a commercially available unit. There's a couple units that are in development that I've referenced here, but I won't go into those in a lot of detail. The couple of major differences to know between both ViewRay and Elekta units. The first is that the ViewRay unit uses a different MRI field strength. It uses a 0.35 Tesla versus the Elekta that uses a 1.5 Tesla. And there's I think some differences there that we're working hard to study and understand, that it's hard to know if one is better than the other, but they're just different. You know, there's different types of images that are acquired there. The bore sizes are relatively similar, beam strengths are similar. And the ViewRay group has done a phenomenal job of really publishing a lot of their clinical outcomes, which we'll go through some of those today. But really, really talented group of people using the ViewRay device, and they've done just a great job of publishing a lot of those outcomes. We have been working hard with the Elekta device to publish outcomes. We've had it only approved now for about a year, so hopefully in the coming years there'll be an increasing number of clinical publications coming out focused on using the Elekta device. This is a schematic courtesy of Parag Parikh of the ViewRay device, just showing kind of what it looks like and the exterior pictures of it. This is the Elekta device again, and major difference here being the strength of the MR imaging device, either a 1.5 Tesla or a 0.35 Tesla. But at the core of both of these devices are relatively major changes in what a radiation oncologist is doing and how they're actually generating a treatment plan on a daily basis. So I try to represent this in schematics and describe this to colleagues, but the biggest difference here, as most of you probably know, is that when we deliver CT-guided radiation, we're often creating a plan at the initial CT simulation. We create a plan using the CT simulation, and then we use that same plan throughout a treatment course, whether that's a fractionated treatment course or a stereotactic ablative radiation treatment course. We typically will use the same plan. With MR-guided radiation, we frequently have a reference plan, but then we're creating a new plan on a daily basis that adapts to the imaging of that day. So we're recontouring in many circumstances and accounting for subtle differences in normal organ location and anatomy differences, that sort of thing, which represents a pretty major change in the methodology by which we're delivering MR-guided and image-guided radiation therapy. This requires a lot of time and is obviously a major change in the workflow. So let's take a look at some select publications on MR guidance. So this is just a review of some of the evidence levels that exist. I would say right now we're probably, maybe at the level two evidence for where we are with MR guidance. Ideally, over the coming years, we'll move into level one evidence. And I think if we as a specialty can really commit to this, we can generate the type of evidence needed to show that adaptive MR-guided radiation may be quite advantageous for our patients, but it's going to require a real commitment to enrollment in clinical trials. Well, there's a couple of really nice publications. This is one example from the group at WashU that have looked at adaptive online MR-guided radiation. This is just describing some of the first clinical experiences. This was using the ViewRay device. And it shows you a little bit of the thought process that a radiation oncologist goes through when doing adaptive MR-guided radiation therapy. You start out typically with an image of the day, and you really have to assess that image for changes in the normal organs or potential changes that you want to recontour and adapt for. And this is a really evolving question. When you adapt, how you're selecting to adapt is something that our specialty is really going to have to focus on with careful clinical research in the coming years to determine how to best do that. And then typically you'll get a new plan of that day that will either be acceptable or unacceptable. And these are real-time decisions that often a radiation oncologist is making while the patient is on the treatment table. And there have been multiple publications looking at the role of daily plan adaptation in MR-guided radiation. This is another nice one from the group in the Netherlands, looking at that for the stereotactic ablative radiation treatment for adrenal metastases, just describing that there are some significant interfraction changes in OAR positions. Despite having really robust and a nice imaging acquisition that was acquired at the outset. This is just another example of an early clinical publication looking at the feasibility of stereotactic radiation using the 1.5 Tesla MR-Linac produced by Elekta. This is from the group at Utrecht, just describing some of their early clinical experiences using that device. You can see an example here of some of the imaging that's acquired, which does give you, I think, a very, very nice level of clarity, highlighting, for example, structures like the ureter that are close by a lymph node that you may want to deliver an ablative dose of radiation to. There have been some really nice multi-institutional retrospective series that have been published. This is one led by Mike Bassetti and Steve Rosenberg at University of Wisconsin. Essentially, a retrospective collection of MR-guided stereotactic body radiation treatments for liver patients, just showing a variety of liver patients. There were some hepatocellular carcinomas in here, some cholangiocarcinomas, and the metastatic lesions. Just describing clinical outcomes, which in this publication, Freedom from Local Progression, was pretty good. There have been multiple publications like this, specifically for the liver patients. This is another one from the group at Henry Ford, again, just describing their clinical experiences using the Array MR-Linac. There have been other retrospective evaluations, specifically of decision making in MR-guided radiation therapy treatments. This is a very nice publication from Percy Lee's group. When he was at UCLA, that really describes this important decision making that takes place with regard to daily image visualization. And the important point from this is that the daily image visualization was potentially not reliable to determine the benefit or not from adaptive radiation therapy, and that really online predictive planning based on deformed and manually adjusted contours are really ideal for doing that, and that really should be considered each day. And I think that this is a really nice publication examining the use of these very time-consuming online adaptive procedures that we really need to be looking at in a variety of tumor sites to figure out when this really needs to be done routinely and if there are criteria that we need to be looking at in other ablative radiation therapy procedures to really hone in on who needs this adaptive treatment when. Just a very nice year from their publication. This is another publication looking at the use of MR-guided radiation for the treatment of inoperable pancreatic cancer. There is a nice prospective trial ongoing right now in this space, but this is a retrospective example. 44 patients were treated in this with inoperable pancreatic cancer. And essentially, this suggested potentially that higher dose treatments with radiation could improve overall survival. And I think this is something that we've seen now in multiple publications that ablative high dose radiation, when given very conformally and accurately, accounting for normal organ movement and daily positioning, can potentially result in improved clinical outcomes for pancreatic cancer. Something I think we need to prospectively verify and potentially look at in large cohorts of patients. So this is another example of a nice prospective single-arm phase 2 study of stereotactic MR-guided radiation for prostate cancer. This is from the group in the Netherlands as well. Again, showing some early toxicity results. We really need long-term follow-up on this cohort of patients, but a really nice start here in terms of publications. This is over 100 patients, mostly with intermediate or high-risk prostate cancer that were treated using MR-guided radiation therapy, mostly SBRT here, delivered in five fractions. They did 7.25 gray to the target volume in five fractions. And then they describe a relative urethral sparing that they did, which they brought the urethra to 6.5 gray per fraction. They had really low rates of grade 2 toxicity, both GI and GU toxicity, acute toxicity events in this publication. And obviously, long-term follow-up is ongoing. This is an example of some of the images that were acquired for the purposes of image guidance, and you can see a very nice illustration of where the urethra is, as well as where the prostate is. So this is another example, single institution phase 1/2 study of single fraction high gradient adjuvant partial breast irradiation for early stage breast cancers. This was 50 patients with low risk hormone sensitive breast cancers treated on a prospective clinical trial. Again, I highlighted this to show the really nice imaging that you can see here illustrating the cavity. This is patients that were given accelerated partial breast irradiation delivered in a single fraction postoperatively, just using these external beam techniques. Toxicity was really favorable in this publication. So if you're interested in this type of thing, this is really a really well done publication that you could reference. And this was re very recently published in the Red Journal. This was tumor response after neoadjuvant MR-guided single dose ablative partial breast irradiation, which I think is very provocative. And this was a total of 36 patients that were enrolled on the study. And you can see here that of those patients, they had a pathologic complete response reported in about 15 of them. So I think very intriguing, interesting results that ideally will be repeated and expanded in larger cohorts, but definitely promising that they saw, about 42% rates of pathologic complete response. And they actually saw radiologic complete response in about 15 patients as well. So potentially promising, illustrating that with very acceptable, I think, toxicity results, this could potentially be a non-operative management strategy for some patients. Obviously, it requires a lot more data and a lot more investigation in the future, which is ongoing. There are multiple prospective ongoing trials that are currently accruing for MR-guided radiation therapy. We probably accrue about 95% of our patients into a prospective registry trial when they're treated in our department, which I think is really, really important if we're going to try and demonstrate the value of this technology going forward and publish really high quality results using these expensive and time-consuming pieces of technology. So these are the levels of evidence that are available currently for supporting MR guidance. Ideally, we need to really move into level one evidence, and I think we as a specialty have to work very hard to do that in the coming years. So I thought I'd show a couple case examples as we sort of wrap up here of cases that we recently treated with MR guidance that potentially highlight some of the utility of these devices. This is a 46-year-old female with a history of ocular melanoma who presented in follow-up with a lesion on her liver MRI. She'd been previously treated with an ablative dose of radiation to the liver, and then she had a lesion seen in follow-up. So you can see here the fat-suppressed T2 image nicely illustrates where that lesion is. But on the CT sim, as well as even the post-contrast diagnostic CT, it's very, very difficult to see where that lesion was located, but nicely illustrated on the MR. So this is an example of for imaging from the MR-Linac, again, illustrating nicely where that lesion was on a respiratory-triggered T2. And then I think it can be well visualized with the other images that we acquired here. So she was treated with stereotactic body radiation, 45 gray in three fractions. You can see her plan here, nicely kind of overlaying the where that lesion was. This sort of illustrates our workflow, we active planning process. So this was the patient's 1 month follow-up MRI, and you can see very nicely that there's this void that was created in her MRI scan on the deliverievest that nicely overlaid with her isodose lines. This is another case that we recently treated. This is a patient with a history of oligometastatic renal cell carcinoma. This was an enlarging lesion that was present on multiple scans. He met with interventional radiology and was concerned about the proximity of this lesion to his aorta, and as a consequence, wanted to talk about some non-invasive ablative procedures for this. And we ended up offering, after multidisciplinary conference and consultation, we ended up offering him stereotactic radiation therapy. This is an example of his treatment plan. You can see we had a 50 gray isodose line and then some central heat going to 60 gray over five fractions. Max doses in this were in the mid 60 range, all kind of focused in that tumor. So this is an example of his onboard imaging. You can see the this is beam on imaging. You can see that the lesion can be nicely visualized there, and with respiration, it's remaining within our PTV that we have delineated there in green. We can also watch for any critical other normal structures, making sure that they don't come into too close of proximity to that ablative region of radiation. So this treatment went quite well. The patient tolerated it very well, and it was very happy with the overall treatment course. So this is another example courtesy of Mike Vasetti at the University of Wisconsin, illustrating a case that was recently treated there for metastatic breast cancer with liver metastases near the stomach. This patient required a high dose of radiation, obviously in very close proximity to the stomach. This was treated at 60 gray and five fractions, and you can see here some nice sculpting and accounting for the daily position of the stomach with each daily fraction. In the last couple of slides, I just want to give some sort of thought-provoking slides to all the radiation oncologists in the audience. If you think about these tremendous technological advancements that have taken place over the past 40 years, and you look back at, for example, a trial that took place in 1981, this was a well-known Gitzig trial that treated patients with unresectable pancreatic cancer to 40 to 60 gray, and you now fast forward 40 years, considering all these technological advances that have taken place to the 2020 NCCN guidelines. For many patients, the core radiation dose and fractionation schedules that we're recommending have, in some cases, changed relatively little. And that's not certainly not the case across the board, but in many cases it is. And one of the questions I think we as a specialty need to consider very carefully is how much has radiation really become personalized in the past 40 years? And do we have an ability here with the biological imaging capacity of MRI to potentially investigate more in novel methods of personalizing radiation dosing? So there are some perhaps obvious examples and advantages of MR guidance, things like seeing while we treat, a nice and excellent ability to image guide dose. But then there are some potentially, and I emphasize potentially because we really don't know this, but potentially transformative aspects of MR guidance, things like daily functional imaging assessment, daily biological imaging. Could we come up with a hybrid of this concept of daily biological imaging and radiation treatment and have signatures of tumor response and really change what defines success in radiation therapy dosing? And it becomes very logical to hypothesize that we could have a novel method of determining radiation dose. So rather than reaching an arbitrary dose of 50 gray or 60 gray, we may have a biological imaging threshold or a signature that the patient would cross during treatment that would be potentially correlated with a clinical outcome. And this is a somewhat of a novel idea, but I think it be potentially becomes reality in the era of routine acquisition of daily MRIs for guidance. This is some examples of how we're doing that on prospective trials. This is a brain patient that was recently treated, just illustrating changes in the GTV and PTV over the course of treatment. This is from Michael Straza at the Medical College of Wisconsin. So with that, I'd like to conclude. I'd like to really thank my collaborators, particularly individuals that I work with on a national level and as well as international level. This is the team at MCW. Just note that there's only three radiation oncologists here. The rest are physicists, just illustrating the complexity of these machines. This is Paul Konectis. He's a diagnostic radiologist that helps me with a lot of treatment planning and MR interpretation. I'd also like to thank Parag Parikh, Mike Bassetti, Percy Lee, and Carrie Glidehurst at Henry Ford, who's really been phenomenal collaborators and helped me with some of these slides. I'd be happy to take any questions during the live session. Thank you very much.